I'm doing the last additions to the program that all of you who begin in January 6th, 1990, will all receive a copy of this. This will be about, it's now 25 pages. It'll be close on to about 30 pages. And this will be what is called in writing a précis of the book. And the book is well on its way to being 300 plus pages, and that will come out hopefully sometimes towards the end of 1990 or the beginning of 91. It doesn't really matter. That book will present the Saturday program as an accomplished fact, as a feat which has been done, as an instrument for helping human beings to learn how to learn. Because you can't know anything until you know how to know. And the key, the trigger, in knowing how to know is to have acquaintance with the knower. If you don't have any acquaintance with the knower, there's no way that you can guess your way. There's no stochastic process, is the probability, people say, which through trial and error yields the right answer. It doesn't matter how large a room full of monkeys and how many computers you give them, they will never write War and Peace. It's not an accident of probability. It is the precision of purpose, of consciousness, that accomplishes the task. And so self-realization can never be guessed at. I guess the most eloquent of all the classic presentations is one time the Buddha is asked after a sermon, and he's asked the question pointedly and specifically, that in your omniscient consciousness, was there ever a sentient being anywhere in the universe whoever guessed their way to enlightenment? And his answer was, not a single one. But his answer was complete. It's not only not a single one yet, but never. Never will be. So that forever and always, practice is the necessary path that one has to take. And as you participate in practice, the invisible substrate which practice assumes more and more comes into possibility. And that substrate is called theory. But it isn't theory like in the derisive way in which the English language has slid into it, and we think of theory as speculation. Theory comes from the Greek, and the Greek term, theoria, meant contemplation, the view in contemplation. So that theory, theoria, and practice, practice, in the original Greek language, meant the two hands by which one can do something, given yourself and given the world in which you have to work. Theory and practice go together. And this is not just a Greek idea, but it is inherent in all of the great primary languages of classical antiquity. Greek, Sanskrit, Chinese, Egyptian. For instance, my spirit mother gave me these two Chinese figurines before she died. And she said very gently, in her kind of a French gypsy way, she said, this is the real Tai Chi, you know. Work and study. That's really how the Tao works, work and study. And so theory and practice. But it's a technical understanding. It isn't just a catchphrase. It isn't just a colloquial phrase at all. It's very exacting. In order to have theoria, you have to have contact with the deep self. And the deep self is not a thing which you can just have contact with because of its nature. Any kind of approach to it already involves you in the deep self. You don't have it. It subsumes you. And of course, every resistance that you have comes into play not to be subsumed. And so contact with the deep self is precarious exactly because it is always interpreted as existential death. And the question that any 5-year-old knows enough to ask when they go through that bad dream stage, what's going to happen to me? And the answer, of course, that a loving parent always gives is that you're going to wake up in the morning. So the Bodhisattva parent says, you'll wake up again. Life does not die. It sleeps. It has phases. It has quantum jumps. But you're not going to die. You're not of that category of things which die. But you do in your phasic sequencing, wax and wane. It's in the nature of your quality. You will wake again. Do not worry. And so the experience of approaching the deep self, though it is ultimate precariousness itself, you must do it. It's necessary. And always the quality which is most prized eventually is courage. Or if you like, spiritual courage. It becomes the central virtue. But the spiritual courage is not something which you can have. It is always something which you must give. The way that you have it is that you give it to others. And so it's not called spiritual courage in its precision, but it's called compassion. The Sanskrit term for it is karuna. The Greek term for it is theoria. That in contemplation, one is constantly giving. It's different from meditation. Meditation is a concentration, is an integration, but compassion is a differentiation, is the giving. And you have to shift into the giving mode in order to approach the deep self because of all of the death resistance qualities that are there constantly. And so in a way, the only eyes that you can use along the path at a certain critical stage are the eyes of foresight. The Greek term is pronaos. It's the Promethean gift to man. The creative fire that Prometheus gives to man is foresight. Pronaos. So that, for instance, one of the finest of all the esoteric occult books in the last couple hundred years is called The Pronaos of the Temple of Wisdom. Because in classical antiquity, before you entered into the temple, there was always that kind of porch that kind of airlock, that kind of architectural structure that serves the function of reminding you now to have foresight. Do not just walk from the profane world into God's home. Why? Because if you just do that, if you carry worldliness into his home, the stench of the worldliness will dissolve you before the altar of God immediately. It's like the whole point of the spiritual education in the book of Job. Yes, you do have a direct link to God, but you can't just use the direct link. You have to have a little loop of circumspection to show reverence before you can indeed approach, because you are carrying the echoes of death with you from this world, and you must suspend them before you can go into the presence of divinity. So there are mysteries, and there always will be mysteries, because it is mysterious. And the wisest teaching is that when it comes right down to it, when you have to do it, you have to understand that no one really knows. And it's not a not knowing because of ignorance, it's a not knowing because there is no way to know. But one can know with great precision what you do not know. That's the science of it. And with very great precision, you can prepare yourself for the moment when you must give up your choreographic control. And it's very important to learn how to do that. I suppose someone thinks I should answer the phone. Someone who doesn't know me well enough to know that at this time I teach. It's amazing, isn't it? Maybe it's a signal then to move on. In the foresight, in the pronouns, in the using of this foresight then, as we approach the critical summation of this whole two-year program, I want to be able to prepare you. I want you to have a kind of a preparation. Even those who are not going on with it, not going to make full use of it, oh, there's something here for you also. In all the spiritual heritage of the world, and there are many possibilities, I've selected out a synaptic gap which I believe carries the necessary amperage of purpose to effectively help us. The two ends of this synaptic gap are Thoreau and the Bhagavad Gita. I was very carefully chosen and tailored because there is quite a connection between Thoreau and the Bhagavad Gita. In our education, we're going to begin January 6th with a little written essay out of the portable Thoreau, which means then make a note to yourself to go and get a copy of the portable Thoreau someplace. It's been out for 30 or 40 years, and there are used copies or new copies everywhere. We're going to begin with his little essay, Walking. And here's the first couple of sentences of Thoreau's Walking. I wish to speak a word for nature, for absolute freedom and wildness, as contrasted with a freedom and culture merely civil. To regard man as an inhabitant or a part and parcel of nature rather than a member of society. I wish to make an extreme statement. If so I may make an emphatic one, for there are enough champions of civilization. The minister and the school committee and every one of you will take care of that. And the statement that he wishes to make is the whole essay, Walking, which takes up about 30-some pages, 35 pages or so. So we're going to begin January 6th with Thoreau's Walking in Nature. Okay, there's that January 6th. But the week before that, we're going to end with the Bhagavad Gita. We're going to end our whole two-year cycle with the Bhagavad Gita, and then jump from the Bhagavad Gita to Thoreau. But not just the Bhagavad Gita. Do you know that the Bhagavad Gita is a part of a very large epic called the Mahabharata? And the Mahabharata, in English translation, takes up about 12 volumes. It's many times longer than the Odyssey and the Iliad combined. There are 18 parvans in the Mahabharata. The sixth parvan is the Bhagavad Gita. So the Bhagavad Gita is the sixth out of 18 sections of the national epic of ancient classical India. So the Bhagavad Gita is the place in the recitation of the epic where the hand of understanding can grasp the whole in a way not to balance it. That would be around the ninth section. But at the sixth section is to balance it, to be able to throw it like a javelin, to throw it in your understanding of its purpose. So that just as the Bhagavad Gita is the sixth out of the 18 sections of the Mahabharata, the sixth section of the Bhagavad Gita is exactly the place where your ring finger would grab the sphere of the whole to throw it with purpose. The purpose is self-realization. To throw it to yourself. What does it mean? And so the sixth section of the Bhagavad Gita is the center of the center in the dynamic structure. So we're going to end a week before getting to Thoreau's Walking with the sixth section of the Bhagavad Gita. I'll go into it in great detail and bring out for you a quality. Here's how it begins. Krishna is in his dialogue with Arjuna. And Krishna says, "He who works not for an earthly reward, but does the work to be done, he is a sannyasi, he is a yogi, not he who lights not the sacrifice fire or offers not the holy sacrifice." There's a very complicated, convoluted specificity here. The sacrifice fire referred to here is the Agni Yoga ceremony out of the Rig Veda. And I have here the 1975 coverage of the Agni Yoga ceremony, two huge volumes from the University of California Press, plus a cassette of the chants, the ancient Rig Vedic chants on tape. And so the week before getting to Thoreau, we'll review somewhat the Agni Yoga sacrifice, the fire sacrifice of the spirit bird from the Rig Veda. We'll review somewhat the Mahabharata and how the Bhagavad Gita fits in there. Then we'll come to the center of the Bhagavad Gita and understand a poignancy, which you have, if you have gone through the full two-year program, you should be able to realize at that point. If not, do the best you can. Then we'll leap the next week to Thoreau's Walking. Now, Thoreau's Walking occurs at a time in his life when he had read the Bhagavad Gita, and he was one of the first people in the West to read it with comprehension. The Gandhians always referred to Thoreau as the Upanishadic sage of North America. Is there anyone in the American culture who had the spiritual maturity of an ancient Upanishad? Henry David Thoreau, Concord, Massachusetts. And he was always regarded in that light. And so the Gandhians used Thoreau's essay on civil disobedience, not in a political way, but because it was the way of action of a Upanishadic master. It contained the essence of Anasakti Yoga, which is the refined technical karmic yoga brought to a perfection. In the sixth section of the Bhagavad Gita, the culminating point of the point of the point, the Mahabharata has the Bhagavad Gita at its dynamic center. Not its static center, its dynamic center. The sixth section of the Bhagavad Gita is the dynamic center of the Bhagavad Gita, and the very last sloka of the sixth section of the Bhagavad Gita is the point within the point within the point. It's the dynamic center realization. And I'm going to use here the translation done by R.C. Zahner, Oxford University Press, 1969. His particular translation of this is the best that there is. Juan Mascaro's generally okay as an introduction, but we need the most exact of all of the translations. This is the last couplet, the last sloka, of the sixth section of the Bhagavad Gita, which is the sixth section in the Mahabharata, which is the primary psychic structure of ancient India. It reads in translation, "But of all athletes of the spirit, the man of faith, who loves and honors me, his inmost self absorbed in me, he is the most fully integrated. Thus do I believe." Now this phrase, the first phrase that occurs in this sloka, which Zahner rightly translates it as athletes of the spirit, and athletes of the spirit is a metaphorical ancient Sanskrit metaphorical phrase which refers to, which means the yogins, someone who is a master at the complete range of yoga, would be an athlete of the spirit. This exact phrase was used by the Rosicrucians in the 17th century to refer to someone who had trained himself to be in the presence of God. An athlete of the spirit. The exact same phrase. So that later on, when the yogic techniques became more familiar in the West, many insightful Western esotericists said, well, look here, Rosicrucianism was a Christian yoga. And indeed it was. Not because there was an influence in terms of the 17th century Rosicrucians having contact with India, but rather that the 17th century Rosicrucians had contact with the deep self to the same perilous exactitude that the ancient yogis had. And so they used a similar kind of phrasing, because that's really what one means to say. That when you get used to having your mobility in spiritual presence, it's like being an athlete of the spirit. To put it in a colloquial phrase, if I may be permitted, you feel really good. You feel like you can do it. And so the colloquial phrase of someone who does that is an adept, because you're ready to go. You can do it. Not only in someone's mind, but in your body. You see, because you must understand the athlete. Body is in shape. His physiological presence in a time-space world is also in tune. The whole purpose of the yoga is to tune yourself. And in tuning yourself, tune this world. Because that's the way the scale of creation runs. If you're in tune, the world around you has to come into tune. Any interchange that it has with you tunes it. And so the spiritual person, wherever they are, by just walking through a place, integrates the nature completely to the atomic level, to the molecular level. So these two connections, the Bhagavad Gita and Thoreau, will be the last week of the program and the first week of the last cycle of the program. That's the connection. That's the synaptic gap that I wish to establish and wish to present. Now, coming back from that, leaving that poignancy for a moment, coming back to that, to try and calm down and let our human sense assess, what does this mean then? Like one prospective student who's coming for the first time, she wanted to know, does this mean I'm going to leave my husband? You don't have to leave your jobs. You don't have to leave your families. In ancient times, where it was very difficult, you would have to do that. But we have possibilities now where you can just, you don't have to give up your Slurpees and you don't have to give up your Porsches. But you do have to give up identifying yourself with needing it. So you have to gain in compassion as you lose the desperate motive to need them. And so the development of a kind of a heart wisdom, the winged heart, the heart wisdom goes along with that penetrating prajna that comes. So this will be the beginning of the way in which the program is characterized in print. And I'll just read this to you for the first time, and then we'll take a short break, and then we'll come back to our material. No future exists without real education. Future as existential possibility relies on an extended past, enduring through a present order. Without an extended past, without a present order, no future exists. Even an idea like, quote, the future, connotates experience and understanding woven into a transmissible continuity, which most certainly is the reality of education as an idea. Tradition does all this, educating, for man on a tribal or family level. Even on a national level, tradition is the way education generally works. Most curricula, more or less, reflect traditional values pumped into mass production teaching. Schools traditionally are vehicles of social continuity of its traditional values. And put in these words, a certain tautological short circuit becomes apparent at last. Tradition develops itself. Traditional values are self-interest justified by characteristic techniques of weaving the extended past into some present order so that a continued future will obtain. In this ecology of societal cycle and educational ceremony, the primary function served is continuity of events. This continuity of events is a natural level called tradition. It's the mythology, or rather the very context of the mythology, by which the meaning of it all is generated. But beyond this is another scale, another level. Beyond tradition in its mythic reinforcement is the conscious level of personality with its historic reinforcement. A whole other scale, a whole other proportion. And in fact, a kind of a sense of proportion that in fact, in a colloquial sense, turns nature inside out, turns tradition inside out. Now you have to see this dynamically. Use your imagination to make a picture of yourself, for yourself. Here is tradition in the shape of a cone. Think of a truncated conic section in your mind. Now how can you turn in your imagination, that cone inside out? Notice that in turning that cone inside out dynamically in your mind, that midway from turning the cone inside out into its complementary cone, midway in that process you have a circle with a dot in the center. If you made a cross-section exactly at the center of that process of turning the cone inside out, you would have a plane, which is a circle with a dot in the center. That's the first kindergarten exercise in being able to have an image of the eternal. Notice that the generative base for projecting the cone has now become the center of a circle. In a very elementary sense, you now have your first picture of the deep self. But it's just a bubble chamber snapshot of one approach, the geometric image approach to it. Notice, though, that the reality, the Heraclitean reality, the reality in a kind of a calculus way, is that it is not a circle with a dot at the center. It is a cone which goes from one conformation through that plane to its complementary opposite. So the truth is that the deep self is not a circle with a center in it, but is the process by which a cone turns itself inside out, and midway through one could have a snapshot of a circle with a center. Now what do we have? Now we have a jump from the kindergarten circle with the dot in the center to the first grade level where one has a continuous process of transformation. which characterizes the dynamic presentation of the deep self in an image tone. It still is not the deep self at all, but we have a much more sophisticated image capability. The circle with the dot in the center is a geometric symbol of the deep self, but the cone turning itself inside out is a trigonometric symbol of the deep self. Notice that in between the geometric and the trigonometric is a giant quantum step. A giant quantum step. Can you now imagine that there is no way to make an image of the next quantum step beyond the trigonometric? Why? Because the image capacity doesn't extend to the invisible realm where the next step registers. The next footprint is not available for trigonometric space, just like the trigonometric space was not available for geometric space. Where is the next step? The next step is outside of time-space. Don't get me wrong, there is a next step. And you can walk just as surely on that next step as you can on any plane on the planet. But the next step is outside of time-space. Where is the next step? The next step is in consciousness, in the dimension of consciousness, outside of the dimensions of space-time. That next step beyond the trigonometric sphere is so dynamic, so charged, that when you take the step, you bounce. And the bounce that happens initiates the Maya of the universe. The dance of all that is the reverberation of that next step having been taken. You want a proof for the existence of God? Anywhere you push against. That's how it got here. There's no other way for what is here to occur. Let's take a break.
Thank you, Molly. You have a I Ching coloring book?
Yeah. There's one in the bookstore of Bodhi.
I've got an I Ching paper doll.
Okay. Come on.
Someone grab it. We saw it last week.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the bowl of paper trigrams. A good one.
Uh-huh.
Perry Bangs. Yeah. Okay. Normally it's $17.
The little Richard Wilhelm book. The small one is only $14.
That's a commentary on the I Ching.
No, the one that you proposed to get.
The edition of the I Ching.
Oh.
So most of you have an I Ching already. Because when we start on the 6th of January, I'm going to start with the way in which the cosmology of the Bhagavad Gita phases back into nature without a trace. And the second lecture is going to pick up with the I Ching. Because there are ways that human beings have of tracking things that leave no trace. No matter how ingenious the Indian mind was, the Chinese mind was able to receive it. And the Chinese mind received even what the Indian mind didn't realize it was sending. That was the birth of Zen. And the Indian mind never understood that. Till the 20th century, when Japanese scholars would explain it to the Indians, look, this is what it is. There was no Zen in India until Japanese scholars like Daisetsu Suzuki made it explicable in English, and now there's a little bit of Zen in India, but there never was. I mean, the whole issue that there is no Zen in India tells you something. It's really significant. It's like gong. It's amazing, yeah. I mean, what there is to know is extraordinary. But what there is to not know is even more amazing. Just one little addition, one little corollary. Thoreau learned about the Bhagavad Gita because a friend of his from England, who has a very long name, but it's pronounced Chumley, Thomas Chumley, sent him a whole box of the classics of India translated into English. 40-some volumes. So that Thoreau got a tidal wave of ancient Asian wisdom. And one of the amazing things is that Thoreau, in his late 30s when this happened, was able to pick up that whole tidal wave of Asian wisdom and understand it. In other words, he was extraordinarily accomplished. I mean, he's just like an old Upanishadic master. Part of the preparation for Thoreau was in an odd kind of a sequence. He lived for a long time with Emerson. Ralph Waldo Emerson lived in Emerson's house. You're familiar with Thoreau building the cabin at Walden Pond. The land on which he built it was owned by Emerson. Now, Emerson's house, incidentally, was located right at the end of Concord, of the bridge over the Concord River. And the American Revolution started at the other end of that bridge. And Emerson, in a very symbolic way, saw that that revolution that started at that end of the bridge is going to reach its culmination at this end of the bridge. Now, you have to understand that Emerson is always thought of as a quintessential American, but you have to understand that he is not a quintessential American in the sense that you usually would think this. Emerson's basic culture was German idealism. Emerson read and spoke German perfectly. And if you ever look at a list of Emerson's library, the really major portion of his culture is German. He had over 140 books by and about Goethe. Now, what's interesting about the German idealism that was in the background of Emerson is that there is a strong current, which we now are used to calling, because of the way in which the academic universities have labeled things and pigeonholed them, we call that Romanticism, or transcendental idealism as the idea behind Romanticism. But there are two distinct phases in the German transcendental idealism, which is the concept powering Romanticism as a way of life, way of comporting to life. The first phase belongs to Immanuel Kant. The second phase belongs to Arthur Schopenhauer. It is the second phase. It is the Schopenhauerian phase